Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight with Professor Ephraim Inbar. Makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He was here a few years ago talking about domestic Israeli politics. I'll introduce our speaker briefly. Educated at Hebrew University and the University of Chicago, he's written five books and many, many articles. He's an expert in national security and currently president of the Jerusalem Institute for Strategic Studies. Late last year, in cooperation with the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, our speaker wrote the special report, The Wattle and the Olive, A New Chapter in Australia and Israel Working Together. And tonight, Professor Inbar is going to speak for us on the topic of the centennial of the Battle of Beersheba, Australia-Israeli relations. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you for inviting me again. I'm happy to be here. And in recent years, I was quite involved in Australian-Israeli relations. And generally, I found your country very friendly, and it's always good to be here. And your prime minister is now in Israel, reciprocating the visit of Netanyahu, which reflects a new stage in the relations between our two countries. And the excuse is the Battle of Beersheba. And I've been here almost every year in the last 7-8 years. And I understand that for you Australians, this is a very memorable event. Mm. Unfortunately, for the Israelis, they hardly know about it. And I admit it's not right, because it was an important chapter in our history. It's not only about some courageous Australians charged, against the well-defended lines of the Ottoman soldiers. Actually, this battle is of consequence to the state of Israel. And it was the battle that broke the defense lines of the Ottoman Empire, which eventually brought about to its destruction. And only as a result of the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire, it was possible to have a British mandate over Palestine and eventually a state of Israel. So we owe you great debt and for your ancestors that came from far away to fight, and eventually benefited a lot. Actually, even the Balfour Declaration, which was the signal of the British Empire to the Zionist movement at the time, that it will favor the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine, happened only after the British in London received the news of the victory in Beersheba. And again, to some extent, the international legitimacy, if we need it, I don't think we need it, but if the international legitimacy given to us, rendered to us by the Balfour Declaration, it's again as a result of the Austrian Light Horse Regiment. Interestingly, in World War II, again, you were on the right side. You fought against evil. Against Nazi Germany. I don't know if you know, but Moshe Dayan, our famous general who became eventually defense minister, foreign minister. He lost his eye. He had a badge, if you remember, there's a picture. He lost his eye accompanying Aussie troops in fighting against France or Vichy in Lebanon. So it's maybe symbolic of you know, our common struggle. In Palestine, during World War II, there were Australian troops. And from what I hear, you know, they left many broken hearts. No, nice looking Australians, young, with energy. And we had also this. Of course, after the war, Australia received a lot of Jewish refugees, Holocaust survivors, who found a hospitable home, and some of them are, of course, here, still here, and it's Australia is good to the Jews. This is not something self-evident in other places, and you know, as a Jew, I want to thank, you know, Australians for allowing the Jewish community to prosper and to become part of your society. Not every country is so good to the Jews as Australia. Another Australian contribution is, of course, the birth of Israel. The birth of Israel was a result of a United Nations special committee that was headed by an Australian diplomat, Abbott, who suggested the partition plan of 1947 that was voted at the UN in 47. And again, you were at the birth. And I don't know if it's divine intervention, but you are there when we needed you. And I think that, you know, in Israel, I try to explain it to my fellow, you know, citizens, students. And I hope that, you know, this visit of your prime minister will indeed make a contribution to a better understanding of Israelis to the historic debt we owe Australia. We have many similarities. You know, we are small nations. You are just about 20, 25 million. We are 8 million. We are immigrant nations, which means that a lot of people from different countries, different languages, different cultures come together. And both of our countries succeeded to, you know, to stay despite adverse, you know, difficult conditions, democracy. We are vibrant democracies. You have governmental crisis now. We have also, you know, every other month we have governmental crisis. From my meetings with Israel, Australian academics and officials, you know, the Australians are favoring rule-based international order, which Israelis are more skeptic about it. You know, of course, if the international order is American, we are in favor. If the international order would be Chinese, I don't know how enthusiastic it would be. We generally have a more realpolitik outlook on international relations than the Australians that have been very fortunate to be far away from many conflicts, and you are also an island, which makes it easier to defend, and it's more difficult to bother you. We are both allies of the United States because we believe that the values of the American political system are our values. We believe in liberty, in market economies, and you know, the best way to get rich is capitalism, after all. I think we are not very happy with what is happening, you know, and I'll say a few words about it, you know, with the United States nowadays. Both our armies, Australian as well as Israeli, have fought for years. We have combat experience. Again, this is not something self-evident. Many countries don't go to war or believe they live in a paradise until they find out that the paradise is somewhere there, not on Earth. So, and you know, Israelis, of course, fought close to home. You fought, in many cases, you know, far away in alliances. But still, you know, as a former soldier, a former paratrooper, I know what combat experience means. What kind of attitude you develop after being in battle. Unfortunately, we are very far away. To get here, wow, it's 20 hours in air, you know, two flights. It's, and indeed, the main challenge is to try to overcome this distance. And I'll speak about it. We had early diplomatic relations. Australia was among the first countries that recognized Israel. But those relations, economic, it's were not very intensive. In terms of economic terms, to give you an example, Israel is 37th largest trading partner, the 50th largest export market for Australia, which is not very significant. No, we have to be honest. The foreign trade, the trade between the two countries was just $1.3 billion. That's all in 2015-16. Two-thirds of it, you know, it's Israeli. About a third is Australian. Australians have developed recently greater interest in the Israeli economy, particularly because of its high-tech sector. You know, we are the startup nation, and you know, we are quite creative. And we see greater interest and many more missions of Australian businessmen coming to Israel. Sometimes I speak, I'm invited to speak to them, not on high tech, on you know politics. And this is a welcome development. There is also growing interest in Israeli military system. I think that a defense memorandum will be signed between the two countries nowadays. Israeli UAVs are being used by the Australian military in Afghanistan, in Iraq. The Israeli companies are providing command and control systems for the Australian Defense Force. There is some cooperation in cyber, although I'll say a few words, it has to be limited, you know, from our point of view. Interestingly, the Australian government defense force doesn't have a uniformed military attaché in the Australian military attaché is sitting in Ankara, Turkey, and is coming once in a while to visit Israel. I'm sure the time in Israel is better than in Ankara. We also don't have a military attaché here, despite growing you know, interactions. We may see the establishment of an Israeli Rafael factory in Australia in order to meet some of the needs of the Australian Defense Force. What do you complain? Probably not only in Australia, but that the press is unfair to us. I think the prism of Israel is via the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And as a result of that, as a result of a liberal bias, a leftist bias in the international press all over, and of the difficulties understanding the complexities of the Palestinian-Israeli or the Arab-Israeli conflict, makes it difficult to report fairly, and we try to, you know, to fix it. It's impossible. It's a lost battle. We fight even lost battles, you know, just to try to make our point. And I want to, you know, to concentrate particularly on the new strategic glue between our two countries that is very important in order to overcome the distances. And I'll tell you what are the main points of this new strategic glue between our two countries. First of all, it is U.S. decline. We see it quite clearly in the Middle East. Obama administration, you know, was very inactive. It accepted basically the Iranian attempt to attain hegemony. They were speaking in terms of balance of power. Let's be balance of power. When the Arab world actually was unable to balance the Iranians, because it was torn by civil war and by radical Islam. And Trump is not that different. Trump, despite our expectations, is following in many ways the Obama policies of not too much intervention. To give you just a few examples, Saudi Arabia tries to isolate Qatar for getting too close to Iran. The Americans are not supporting Saudi Arabia. They try to mediate. Or in Syria, the Americans basically go along with the Russian plans to pacify the country. The Kurds, anti-Iranian force, had a referendum, which was a strategic mistake in my view, but the Americans went against it. Despite that the Kurds have fought together with the Americans against the Islamic State, and which is a misguided strategy, but if you, this is the only real force that was ready to fight the Iranians, but so it was better to let them fight against each other. But the Americans, Obama as well as Trump, were obsessed with the Islamic State and went along with it. And we see a similar trend in Asia. You know, Obama announced focusing, you know, on Asia, but he has done nothing. And you know, he sent maybe 2,000 Marines to Australia, and at the same time. Obama, and this may change a little bit, has greatly diminished the naval power of the United States. I know very well the figures in the Middle East. The Americans, for the first time, don't have a carrier all the time, neither in the 6th Fleet in the Mediterranean, nor in the 7th Fleet in the Indian Ocean, which reduces drastically their ability to project power. Now, when Trump is visiting Asia, so he sends a few carriers, but they are not going to stay. And we see that everybody in Asia, and I talk to Asians, I'm one of the people in Israel that advocates an Asian foreign policy. You know, Europe is kaput, it's gone. So... I had a dialogue with Singaporeans, and one of the leading Singaporeans, you know, strategists, tells us in a private room, we have to be on the winning side, which means greater caution on part of Singapore in aligning itself with the United States. And this is a feeling I know in Thailand. The South Koreans have their doubts about America. So the U.S. decline, I think, has to bring the two countries together, because we face the same challenges. And of course, the main challenge is the rise of China. In our region, it's quite clear. They built a base in Djibouti. Why do the Chinese need a base in Djibouti? They are very aggressive. At my institute, I stopped I'm inundated with Chinese delegations, and I stopped seeing those delegations that have a translator. I don't know what is translated. So also to cut part of the visits, and they are aggressively trying to convince the Israelis that the Americans are on decline and we should reorient our policy. They are helping Iran. We see North Korean technology in Iran. There is no way that the North Koreans can transfer sensitive technologies to the Middle East without the Chinese knowing about it and agreeing to it. They are so dependent upon China. North Korea is not independent. They are selling weapons to Syria. They are selling missile technology to Syria. Syrian missile infrastructure is North Korea. Maybe, I'm not sure about it, but maybe the nuclear program of Iran has been transferred to North Korea. This explains to some extent why they have so much money for their own missile program, which is very expensive. So China is a problem. China is, of course, an anti-American force. If you paid attention to the speech of the Chinese leader in the Communist Congress, he said openly, we want a role in international affairs. This is a new type of statement on part of the Chinese leadership. We didn't hear this type of language before. They have clear plans to reform their military and to acquire capabilities which will put them in much better condition than to face an American force. We face also the same type of trends. In South China Sea, we see again clearly a very aggressive Chinese behavior. They don't pay attention to international arbitration. When the Philippines got a favorable international arbitration, the Chinese simply ignored it. So, in my view, it's quite clear what they want. It's not just to be nice. They don't sell Confucius. Nuclear proliferation. We have in our region a serious danger of nuclear proliferation. Iran is, of course, the main motor behind it, but if Iran gets it, it may get it soon. Then Turkey. Turkish strategists speak about the possibility of getting a nuclear bomb. And of course, Saudi Arabia and Egypt will not stay behind. Here, in your region, in Asia, of course, the North Koreans are creating a great threat perception in Japan, in South Korea, and from what I understand, the Japanese start thinking about the possibility of acquiring nuclear weapons because they don't trust the Americans. And I don't blame them. They face a surge in China. I heard an Australian general speaking about the possibility of acquiring a nuclear bomb to be able to face the Chinese. I don't know how widespread is this view in your country, but this is something new. And there are clear linkages between East Asia and what the Indians call us West Asia. We are Middle East, they call it West. It's fine, I don't care. The North Koreans are here, the Chinese are helping Iran. There is another clear linkage, radical Islam. We have it. It's Islamic State, which will not disappear. Al-Qaeda is back. And Iran, of course, spreads radical Islam. This is what the whole revolution is about. We see the spread of this type of thinking into Southeast Asia. I was at a meeting with Indonesians, you know, and they were open about it. They are very fearful about the radicalization of their society. And they are not far from you. By the way, I'm not sure that the Chinese will not use radical Islam in order to destabilize countries that are pro-Western. It can happen in Malaysia, it can happen in Indonesia. Of course, they are communist and religion is not exactly the cup of tea, but it's useful. They'll consider them useful idiots. And they are able to do so. They will have no constraints. So we see a new agenda, strategic agenda, that should bring us together, Australia and Israel, because we have the same problem. What can we do together? I think, first of all, we should talk to the Americans. The Americans view Australians a better ally than Israel, by the way. They respect the Australians much more than they respect the Israelis. They believe Israelis have ulterior motives. If we speak together, we try to influence. This is our first on the top of the agenda. How to manage the relationship with America. This is something very important. We don't want to be alone. And if those isolationist impulses that we've seen in the campaign of Trump really are being realized, this is trouble for both of us. I think we should do things, projects in Asia, together, to try to contain, to some extent, Chinese influence. Israel, in recent years, has paid much greater attention to Asian affairs. I'm proud to be part of this intellectual trend. We understand that the international action is moving to the Pacific Rim. And we should be ready to be part of it. And this is where the international action is. I think that Israel is paying much greater attention to a country like India. I don't know if you've seen the visit of Modi to Israel, which was a very successful visit. I was involved for many years in the Indian-Israeli relationship. For example, they buy $1 billion a year, at least, of Israeli military equipment. And we don't threaten them. Buying from the Americans, it's more problematic. And we have the same enemy, radical Islam. We are in Korea. And recently in Vietnam. So we have an Asian presence. I think the synergies between Australia and Israel in this region should be used to attain positive goals. Of course, the Australians can help Israel very much in Indonesia, which is very close to us. Indonesia, because it's Muslim, has a mixed relationship toward Israel, although they are business-oriented. And you can get, an Israeli can go to Australia, to Indonesia, under certain arrangements. I think we should try to establish, and I'm talking multilateral, an Asian democratic international. Japan, Korea, India, Taiwan. Do we want Taiwan to be prey to Chinese expansionists? Taiwan should be helped. We all share similar problems. Terrorism, radical Islam, missile defense issues. I think we should try to establish also a much stronger democratic bloc at the UN in order to reform the UN if it's possible. I'm not sure it is possible. It's in my view, it's a morally bankrupt institution. You have just been elected to the United Nations Human Rights Council, together with the paragons of democracy like Qatar, Burundi, Cuba, China, Saudi Arabia. This is a UN Council for Human Rights. It's a joke. It's a pity. And as democratic countries, we should not allow it to happen. I'm very happy that the Americans left UNESCO. I hope we'll leave UNESCO as well. Because those institutions are not doing good. They are not doing what they're supposed to do. It's just a stage for anti-democratic propaganda. Another issue I think that we should work together is the issue of immigration, illegal immigration. I go sometimes, not too much, to Europe. Some Europeans tell me there is a universal right of refugees to get a house, to get somebody wants to go into your house freely. That's it. That's how they think. I think we should put up a stand for being able to say to a refugee, you are not part of my country. And I admire the Australian policy on immigration. Unfortunately, Israel, which has a problem. You are lucky, you are an island. We have territorial contiguity with Africa. We built a big fence. But some of them are already here. We try to send them back, or the Europeans, or the refugees from Syria in Europe. Yeah, of course, I have much sympathy for them. And you can feed them, but once the war is over, they should go home. Germany, in my view, is not their home. Particularly when their numbers are threatening the culture of the society. If they're ready to integrate, fine. Most of them are not ready to integrate. I'm sure you have ghettos in your country also of people that do not want to integrate into Australian culture and society. Do they have a right to be here? I doubt it. And we should make a moral argument against it. I think it's wrong to try to commit cultural suicide. Countries have a right to continue to be what they are. Now at the bilateral level, both armies have American weapons. There is much to compare. You got F-35s, we also. In the area of intelligence, there has always been intelligence cooperation. And our special agencies have shared information about terrorists, about potential attacks. I must say that I'm not Australian, but I would advise you to try to be more self-reliant, generally. You've been part of an alliance, a good alliance. But can you really make sure that Trump, that tweets every day since the war, will come when you need him? I don't know. If I would have been American, I probably would have voted for Trump. I'm a conservative. But to some extent, he's a disappointment. Some say an embarrassment to the political system, American political system. In the naval area, both countries are near to major choke points along maritime oil and trade routes. We found gas in the Mediterranean. It's very important to defend it. We try to enhance our navy to make it larger. It costs a lot of money, and when you have to choose between butter and guns, many people prefer to butter themselves rather than to spend money for guns. In the naval area, there is a lot of cooperation. It's possible, greater cooperation.
domestic security. Of course, we are very good at domestic security. We have developed doctrines to try to be as safe as possible. It's not foolproof. Nothing is foolproof. But we've done very well in countering terrorism, in finding, yes, in finding the elements that give us trouble. We should share experiences on how to manage Muslim communities. We have 20% Muslims in our country. I'm not sure you are aware of it. There is high tech. There is water management that we can. We have similar problems. Desertification in the. You have a big desert. We have also a big desert, not as big as yours. there are many ways to try to jump over the distance. It's a huge distance between our countries. But I think that we are both countries are the good guys. And good guys should stick together. Thank you.
Many thanks. And so we come to questions and discussion. We've got to the top of the hour. Remember not to stand in front of the camera here. Thanks for a wide look you've taken at Australia-Israeli relations. Just on a matter of Iran, I mean, as you know, President Trump went to Saudi Arabia, spoke to essentially the Sunni leaders, seemed to have had a successful meeting. Our foreign minister, Julie Bishop, I think it's fair to say, was close to John Kerry and the Obama administration on Iran. And according to the reports in the weekend press in Australia, she has expressed concern about the possible approach that President Trump might take to the Iran nuclear deal. Where do you stand on that one? I mean, do you think Trump should continue the Obama policy? Do you think there's reason for him to discontinue the Obama policy? And Australia is in the middle of this somewhere.
Well, my views on the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, are quite clear. This is a very bad deal for several reasons. First of all, there is no real effective inspection. The International Atomic Energy Agency cannot send its supervisors to a place that the Iranians deem a military site. Let's say it's a military site, it's secret, you have nothing to do there. In addition, the deal allows the Iranians research and development on nuclear issues, for example, centrifuges. In the 2 years since July 15, they developed centrifuges 10 times as fast. So it will make, you know, when the deal expires, and people forget that the deal expires in 8 years. It's already for process uranium in a much faster way. And, Obama and the gullible Western leaders forgot that in 8 years, 10 years, the Iranians are at liberty to do whatever they want according to an international agreement. For Western leaders, 8 years is 2 cycles of election. That's eternity. For the Iranians, 10 years is nothing. They are a civilization of over 3,000 years. What's 10 years? So, we'll wait. They are patient. In the Middle East, people have patience. finally, there is no better deal. The Iranians signed the only deal they could live with. They are wonderful negotiators. In Iran, there are no fixed prices. You bargain over everything. And they got a good deal. Therefore, in my view, there is no reason to cancel the deal. There is no reason to bargain for a better deal because there's not going to be a better deal. And the only way to stop Iran from going nuclear is military action. And sometimes Unfortunately, that's what has to be done. And I'm not seeing President Trump, you know, doing such a thing. You know, maybe he threatens. Therefore, Israel on this issue feels very alone. And I advocate to my government to make this difficult decision and go after the nuclear infrastructure or part of it, the sensitive parts, critical parts, in order to prevent a disaster further down the road.
There's a question. You've got to speak. Yes. Yes.
Thank you.
You've got to be brief. Okay.
I need a bit of a minute, but I'll ask you the question in English. Okay. Both Australia and Israel have both signed the agreement that refugees are quite legal and refugees should be given the opportunity to seek asylum, Israel and Australia. What's your view on that?
Well, from what I understand, the refugees are to be allowed some asylum if Israel, for example, is the first country they come to. Israel is not the first country they come to. There are several African countries that are on the way before they reach Israel. Therefore, this agreement doesn't recommend or obligate Israel to treat them as refugees. They are illegal immigrants. Simple. So if it's the first country, it's a very specific clause. If you leave Egypt and come to Israel, then you are a refugee. If you come from Somalia, from Ethiopia, or from other Arab, African country, if you traverse several countries, you are not a refugee. You are a guy that wants to find a job. And the country doesn't have to do
it. In Australia, that's referred to as secondary movement.
Yeah, secondary movement.
You're saying that doesn't... Okay, there's a question here.
Two questions. Would Israel be, do you think, interested in becoming a member of the so-called Five Eyes intelligence system? And secondly, if King Salman remains ruler of Saudi Arabia, what do you see Saudi Arabia evolving into in the next 20 or 30 years?
Well, I come from the land of prophets, but I'm not... I don't know what will happen in Saudi Arabia. There are many potential trajectories. As Mohammed bin Salman is courageous, more active than previous leaders. He has the right ideas. He gave the women the right to drive, which is if this is revolutionary, you know. So. Saudi Arabia might implode. Saudi Arabia may be destabilized by Iran, the eastern province where most of the oil is populated by Shiites. We've seen already attempts by Shiite clergy that is influenced by Iran to foment trouble in this province, and the Saudis executed some. You know, they don't have a law against capital punishment. So we don't know what will happen in Saudi Arabia. Most Arab countries have difficulties holding together. If we take a look at the map, most Arab countries have lost monopoly over use of force, and they have militias. The monarchies are doing a bit better, and maybe Saudi Arabia, that has so much money, will be able to hold the country together. But I cannot tell, you know, how it will look in 20 years.
Question here.
Thanks. About the security question.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah. Well, security question.
The question was whether Israel could join the Five Eyes, which is Canada, Australia, New Zealand, United States, and Britain security arrangements.
I'm not fully aware of those arrangements. We are very suspicious of multilateral forms, because we are we have a doctrine of self-reliance. We are ready to cooperate with the good guys. And for example, in cyber warfare, we are cooperating, but not fully, with many countries, including Australia, because there are certain things that we keep to ourselves, and for well-understood reasons.
Okay, question here.
Thank you very much. I have two questions. When you said Europe is kaput, are you referring to the immigration issue or other issues? And secondly, what do you think is the best way that we can deal with radical Islam?
About Europe, I think that the Europeans have a demographic problem. They don't have children, or enough children. The Europeans have an economic problem because the EU is a bureaucratic institution, so it's no free enterprise. The Europeans also, to some extent, have a political problem. They lost the will to do certain things that are needed in order to survive. Take a look how the discussions in Europe over how to react to Putin, that is aggressor in Eastern Europe. So the Eastern European countries are probably more aware of national security problems. As Western countries are, for some reasons, think they live in a paradise, they don't need militaries, and so it's a different type of attitude. Europe is not a strategic actor, finally. You know, basically, a strategic actor has to... There is no to use force once in a while. Europe doesn't have a military. In Great Britain, they have more horses than tanks, which is good for parades, less effective in war. It's not Europe that we knew once, and the trends there are of great concern. Brexit, in my view, is a positive development, the victory of nationalism over supranationalism. So far, I'm very disappointed by European trends, and it's a pity because Europe is, has a civilizational role. So how can it may go? Of course, immigration. There will be a lot of problems.
Question here.
Thank you, Professor Inbar. Strategic gloom. Compared to Israel, Australia is a country of lotus eaters. A country of lotus eaters. We spend our time in pleasure.
Yeah.
The question is, we have to get backbone, but we are dependent upon China. Coal, iron ore, tourism, and an influx of Chinese students to change other things. How should Australia start viewing its new place in the world in terms of taking its rightful place?
I mean, I think you're invited here to talk about Israel. You're not invited here to talk about Australia. You can talk about it if you want to, but it's not really what the topic's about.
It's your decision whether to be a Chinese colony or not.
I don't think there's any suggestion of Australia becoming a Chinese colony.
Colonel Sanders wouldn't allow.
Okay, please. Who's next? Okay, there's a question down here.
How do you react to the prospect that Israel has sold major infrastructure assets to Chinese sovereign wealth funds? I mean, the telecommunications that they have been major, and China is a major investor in Israel's economy.
Suggestion for those who didn't pick it up, suggestion is that Israel is a major investor in China's economy.
Israel has woken up a bit late about purchases from abroad. I think we are becoming much more careful in what kind of infrastructure projects we can sell. Still, it's a very diversified economy, and the Chinese role in this economy is still limited.
Okay, I think I probably should, I'd go to a question here. I think I probably should say, because you are an Israeli here. I mean, we sell our produce to China because we want to sell it and they want to buy it. They don't buy it because they like us. They buy it because it's a good product at a good price. So it's quite a good relationship. It's not one dependent on the other to any extent. We're both dependent on each other and it works okay, but it doesn't make us a colony of any kind. Craig.
Thanks. I'm wondering if you could give us some guidance on your thoughts around Israel and its Arab neighbours and where any future peace treaties may evolve, given the increased interaction between Israel and a number of the countries there.
In the Middle East, basically the situation of Israel has improved. If we take a look back to the 40s, we have now peace treaties with two Arab countries. One of them is Egypt, which is probably the most important Arab country. We have some kind of agreement with the Palestinian Authority, which is not perfect, but in my view, at least, the status quo is somehow tenable. We have informal relations with the Gulf states, with Saudi Arabia. We see Israeli businessmen in the Gulf with foreign passports usually. Of course, the Saudis and the Gulf countries are very much afraid of Iran, which brings us together. They would have loved, you know, for us to solve the Iranian problem. I believe they've given up on the Americans, particularly during Obama times. Now maybe they are looking at Trump. Syria is in shambles, Libya is in shambles, Iraq, is divided. So the Arab world is in bad shape. If they are able to regroup and rebuild their states, then it is a possibility to have better relations. But they have to overcome, you know, the Islamic reservations about having good relations with a Jewish state, which in many quarters is anathema, ideological, theological anathema.
And moving beyond the Arab states, what about the Israel-Turkish relationship?
Well, Turkey is not Arab. Turkey is on a very bad trajectory. Since 2002, Erdogan rules very effectively in a very sophisticated way Turkey. He has won all the elections. He's now the president. He changed the system. And he is very effective in gradually changing the Turkish society into a more Islamist direction. Erdogan is a Turkish version of the Muslim Brotherhood. And he has done, from his point of view, a wonderful job at the universities, at the judicial system, at the police. All of them are infiltrated with Islamists. Erdogan is anti-Semite, but business is business, so we have diplomatic relations. The main Turkish interest now in Israel is to buy gas from us, from the Mediterranean. Because it's a country with no energy resources and they want to diversify, they don't want to be dependent upon Iran, they don't want to be dependent upon Russia. So this is a source of gas that will ease their dependency and also will strengthen their notion of being a corridor, being a bridge of energy from the Middle East to Europe in order to enhance European dependence upon them. They, of course, they were not accepted to the EU, so they will be happy to get high prices from the Europeans.
Question down here. Second last question.
Professor, a lot of Australians in what they know of Israel see it through the prism of the relationship that Israel has with the Palestinians. And the topic of discussion of the two-state solution features a lot in the discourse here about Israel. A lot of politicians, I think it's fair to say, on both sides, the main parties anyway, are supportive of the idea of the two-state solution. What realistic future does that solution have in your mind? Is it basically approaching the dead and buried stage, or does it still have the prospect of eventual success?
I've written once a piece on the rise of and demise of the two-state solution idea. If we take a look what's happening now in the Palestinian territories, we see that since 2007, one militia, Hamas, has taken over part of the Palestinian territories, Gaza, and is ruling. This is something similar to what's happening in other Arab countries. Hezbollah is taking over Lebanon. Of course, in Somalia, we have many militias. And now, recently, they reached an agreement, and it seems to me that Hamas basically wants a Hezbollah arrangement, that the PA, the Palestinian Authority, will pay for the bureaucrats, will take care of the civilian services, and they will keep their arms, which will give them a lot of influence over the policy of whatever Palestinian entity emerges. Of course, this type of arrangement is very problematic for Israel, but also for the Palestinians themselves. So as long as they are not able to put their house together, I doubt very much if they can reach an agreement with Israelis. Hamas, of course, doesn't have a positive influence over the outcome because it abhors the idea of a Jewish state. So they are opposed to it. As long as there is not enough moderation within the Palestinian political system, we'll not be able to have compromise, a historic compromise between the two national movements.
Final question. Prime Minister Netanyahu has had a successful visit to Australia and he's had good international links with India and other places, so he's doing well on the international stage. What's the politics like in Israel at the moment? I mean, you're a few years off an election, but how is Mr. Netanyahu holding out domestically?
The polls show that he's still the most popular candidate for leading the country. He has domestic difficulties because he seems to smoke a lot of cigars and he gets presents, so he's now under investigation. He has some domestic problems. We don't know exactly what will happen. If he will be indicted by the Israeli law, he doesn't have to resign. Although, I don't know what will happen if he's really indicted. It's in the hands of the judicial system. We have a very strong independent judicial system. And unfortunately, we have a former president in jail. We have a former prime minister in jail that didn't behave as they should have. And the police was after them. And probably Netanyahu, if he sinned, is going to pay for it. Simple. And I have nothing against it, I'm Netanyahu supporter, but if he didn't do it right, he should go to jail or whatever the judicial system decides.
But you do have some former politicians out of jail, don't you? Many thanks.
They manage somehow.
Many thanks. It was great to have Dr. Inbar back at the Institute again, and good luck with your new Jerusalem Institute for Strategic Studies. Tonight we've had a very lively account of Israel's relations with many nations, mainly in the Middle East and North Africa, but also the United States, Europe, Eastern Europe, Africa. We have travelled around and a bit of stuff on the home front. So we were, and on the occasion of the anniversary of Bathsheba, of 1917, and that great historic moment. It was terrific to have you here tonight, and no doubt since you travel here a lot, you'll be back sometime in the future. But for tonight, well done, thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.